We're going to pick up again the theme of resurrection, the resurrection of Jesus. Come to the third part of the series we're looking at on this theme, and to Mark's Gospel, to Mark chapter 16, and to those extraordinary words of the angel to the woman who have come to embalm Jesus. You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene. This is verse 6. Who was crucified? He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. I want to especially think about those words. He is not here. He's not here. The tomb where he was laid is empty. And that is really a very big thing to consider in the history of the world. The empty tomb. Now, we've already seen that it's very difficult for people generally to come and just look objectively at the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, because people have so many what we call presuppositions, ideas that they've picked up that sort of condition their thinking, so they can't see the wood for the trees. So people have things like, well, there isn't a God, so that changes the way they look at everything. Or there are no miracles, miracles can't happen. Or the Bible isn't true, or things like that. And people think that because of these ways that they think, that there's no point in even considering the resurrection as a possibility. And we have to overcome these things. And hopefully you have, but there are many people around us who don't have that privilege yet. And still can't really see what's staring them plainly in the face. We saw last week that the testimony, the strength of testimony to Jesus' resurrection is overwhelming. People tend to think of the Bible as just being one witness to the fact of Jesus rising from the dead. But we saw how there are many, many different witnesses brought together in the Bible, in the New Testament, witnesses who were completely different. They came from all kinds of different angles at the resurrection, and they wrote up their accounts of the resurrection in all kinds of different ways and in different places. And that these accounts were gradually gathered together by the church into this body of material we call the New Testament. But it's a book containing lots and lots of witnesses, a real strength of evidence. But now today I want to get down to some detail. That the tomb is empty. So it's a bit like one of these exercises you get at school. The tomb of Jesus was empty. Explain. How do you explain it? I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say that trying to explain the empty tomb one way or another has taken up more time than just about any other question in the history of the planet. Is it something that captures your own attention? The empty tomb. Because it really is a very, very important thing to square up to in life. I'm going to just look under three headings at it today. I want to think of the empty tomb as important. I want to think of it as inexplicable. But I also want to think of it as indisputable. So it's important. He is not here. That's what the angel says to the woman. He's not here. Sorry. He's not here. Or not sorry. I'm actually quite delighted. He's not here. He's not here. The Gospels present us something very unremarkable, first of all. The fact that a man who's been whipped to within an inch of his life and then crucified dies. And then that he is entombed. Nothing strange about that at all. That's a historical fact, and it's not remarkable. The Gospels also tell us that lots of people know about this and know where he's been entombed. We're told here about Joseph, verse 46, is the man who actually lays Jesus in his own tomb. We're told he was accompanied by Nicodemus in John's Gospel. We're told in verse 47 several women, and the other Gospels tell us about other women too, who saw where he was laid. Peter and John in John's Gospel knew where Jesus was entombed, and probably the other disciples did. Matthew's Gospel tells us that the authorities knew where Jesus was entombed because they set up a guard on the tomb and sealed the tomb. So lots and lots of people know where the tomb is, where Jesus is buried. The tomb isn't somehow lost. People don't somehow get some kind of collective amnesia and forget where the tomb is and go to the wrong tomb on the first day of the week. No, that's not what happens. But then, when they do go to the tomb after the Sabbath, they find that the tomb is empty. A few weeks later, the disciples are busy proclaiming the resurrection. They're busy proclaiming Jesus is risen. From the day of Pentecost, which is a few weeks after this, forward, they're proclaiming the resurrection. I just want to ask, first of all, how important do you think it is that when they do that, that the tomb is empty? How important do you think it is that with the apostles proclaiming the resurrection, that the tomb does not contain Jesus? How important is that? Well, first of all, it's really important because if the tomb did contain Jesus, then when the apostles started telling the world that Jesus was risen, the Jewish authorities, who knew where he had been buried, and who were trying to obliterate the memory of Jesus from the earth, could simply go to the tomb and retrieve the rotting corpse from the tomb and put it on display. And once and for all, they would halt Christianity. They would halt the growing movement. Because the growing movement is based on the resurrection. Peter, on the day of Pentecost, he preaches, God has raised this Jesus to life, and we're all witnesses of this fact. So, open the tomb up, the authorities could do that, produce the body, and there's no story. There's no gospel. There's nothing to preach. There's no church. We're not here. There is no history of Christianity, because the tomb isn't empty. There's a rotting corpse in it, if that's what was the case. But the Jewish authorities didn't do that, and they didn't do that because there wasn't a body, because Jesus was risen. But let's just say again for a moment that there was a body still rotting in the grave or in the tomb, and yet the disciples are out there preaching that Jesus is risen. Do you imagine for a moment that they could do that? That they could preach a risen Jesus if they knew all the time that the tomb still contained his rotting body? Or even if they knew that the body had been moved from that tomb to another tomb and buried somewhere else. The disciples, whom we see from the end of the Gospels on into the book of Acts and beyond, they're proclaiming Jesus at the risk of their own lives. They're proclaiming Jesus boldly. They're proclaiming Jesus is risen. And they're doing that because, quite simply, they know that it's the case. They know that there isn't a rotting corpse in a tomb somewhere, the corpse of their erstwhile friend, Jesus. They know that. It's psychologically impossible for them to preach a risen Jesus if they know that he's still dead. Because that's just not what we see happening in the Gospels. When Jesus dies, they think it's all over. And they think that they've wasted their time with Jesus. Really have. What was the point of our last 3 years? He's dead. The reason they preach that Jesus is alive is because they know he's alive. And it's not something they come to the conclusion of easily. It's not like they say, right, he's dead now, we're just waiting for him to come back. It's not like that. They're completely convinced by their own presuppositions. Jesus is dead and he's going to stay dead. Dead people don't rise until the resurrection at the last day. That's what they believe. And so there's no point in us having any hope at the present time of Jesus coming back to life. But the evidence of what occurs constrains them. They can't turn away from it. he really does rise and they really do see him. And because of that evidence, the tomb is empty, the body is risen, that's why they preach Jesus risen. And there are two words that the New Testament uses time and time again for resurrection. And they really do show what we're talking about. We're talking about not some kind of airy-fairy ghostly thing. We're talking about the physical body that had been beaten and that had been flogged and that had been crucified and that had died, rising again. The two words are the words anastasis, which means to stand up again. That body which was laid down dead has stood up again. And the other word agairo means to raise up. The body is risen up. The physical body is alive. The physical body of Jesus. Now many of us have stood at many's an open grave, and even in just the last few weeks, it's been a sad time in the community. And for many people, that is a finality. Because many people don't believe anything past the physical present life, and they assume that they will never, ever, ever live again, and that those people they've laid in the grave will never, ever live again. They think it's all over. They think the case is closed. All they've got are memories. The resurrection is a big wake-up call to us all that it's not like that. The dead can rise. God's Son has died and has risen. And because of that, we know that this world is not telling its final story when we lay people in the grave. That's not the end. We know that the dead can rise. And I'll speak about this in a few weeks' time. We know that Jesus, being risen, is going to raise others as well. He's going to raise everyone, and we'd better be ready for it. So it's really important that Jesus is risen. But the second thing is, it's inexplicable. Like, it shouldn't happen. And how do you explain that it did? Again, last week I said that there are many people studying the Gospels these days who don't study it from the point of view of Christian faith. They study it from the point of view just of history. There are many people, and they are highly qualified, very technically capable historians who have no personal commitment to the Christian faith, who are studying the New Testament documents, and they are studying the history of the time of the New Testament in great detail. They are agnostics, some of them are atheists, some of them are complete skeptics. And yet, they accept a great deal of the historical data in the New Testament. I'm not talking about just some of these historians, I'm talking about the vast majority of them. And I referred you last week to a guy called Gary Habermas, who's done a lot of work on this, who's gathered the evidence from many, many great scholars. Even some of the most skeptical ones, they say, Jesus lived. Jesus did die on a cross, and the disciples did believe that they saw him alive afterwards. Even if they don't accept that themselves, they do accept that the tomb was empty. They do accept that Jesus died, and that somehow or other, the disciples then believed him to be risen. And that means they've got to try and explain how that could have happened. And because they don't believe in the Christian faith, and they've got these presuppositions like dead men don't live, therefore they've got to try and explain it in some other way. And today and the next couple of weeks I'll mention some of those explanations. One of the ones that keeps popping its head up is one called the swoon theory. And it says this, it says that Jesus didn't die. He survived the cross. And in the tomb, in the cool of the tomb, he somehow revived and then escaped out of the tomb to convince the disciples that he was risen from the dead. That's the swoon theory, or the apparent death theory. And this is kind of popular among people who don't think about this too deeply and want a quick exit from taking the resurrection seriously. it's got a few problems. First of all, problem number one is, you know, just from a medical point of view, people who are medically qualified, who look at the injuries that Jesus suffered with the flagellation that he received, that was actually the worst thing, the flagellation, and then the crucifixion. They say, well, Jesus quite plainly died. He died of something that the medics call hypovolemic shock. He died of a loss of blood so that his circulatory system just couldn't work any longer. And there's no question about it. And the proof of that, as far as the gospel is concerned, is the soldier sticking his spear in the side of Jesus and the blood's already separating out. And the writer says blood and water come out of his side. He's dead. And the Roman soldiers knew a dead body when they had one. But let's just say for a minute he hadn't died on the cross. Let's say somehow he's still just clinging on to life when he's laid in the tomb. Well, he'd have died in the tomb, because he'd have continued to bleed and he'd have died. He certainly wouldn't have found strength somehow to revive and to then be able to shift that big stone and give the soldiers the slip. Hilarious just to think of that trying to be accomplished. But that's what people have to believe if they believe the swoon theory. But there's more than that that's really ridiculous about it. Let's say that Jesus does manage to survive the cross, does manage to revive, does manage to escape out of the tomb. Then he appears to the disciples. Now, what do the disciples see? Do they see a man in the full vigour of his strength saying, I'm risen? No, they see a man who's desperately, desperately in need of medical attention. He's probably going to die from the wounds that he has. He's not in a fit state for anything. And certainly he's not in a fit state to inspire these disciples who are downtrodden and broken, believing that it's all over, that he's actually risen and alive and the conqueror of death. Well, even if that had all happened and the disciples were persuaded, then we're left with one final problem, is this. If Jesus survives the cross, survives the tomb, rolls away the stone, convinces the disciples he's alive, he's a deceiver. Because he hasn't risen from the dead, but he's saying he has. And the disciples are saying it too. So the swoon theory is something to dismiss. Here's what a fellow called David Strauss writes about it. David Strauss was a rationalist. He was a really skeptical guy. He denied miracles. So he wasn't a friend of Christianity at all. But this is what he writes about the swoon theory. He says, it's impossible that a being who had stolen half dead out of the sepulchre, who crept about weak and ill and wanting medical treatment, could have given the disciples the impression that he was a conqueror over death and the grave, the prince of life, an impression that lay at the bottom of the disciples' future ministry. That's David Strauss. So, the thing that actually keeps reviving is not Jesus, but the swoon theory. And then it gets faced with the facts and it dies off again. Because the resurrection is not something you can explain naturally. You can't. It's inexplicable. It's a miracle. In that tomb where the cold, dead body of Jesus lay, a miracle took place. A miracle which is the foundation of the church, and it's the foundation of our hope for the future. Jesus rose from the dead. He has risen. He is not here. But finally, this resurrection is indisputable. It's important. It's inexplicable, but it's also indisputable. And I want to take you to one of the strangest aspects of the story that we probably don't even notice, because our culture is so different to the culture of the time of Jesus. And it's this. Mark chapter 16 starts with a story about woman. Woman going out to embalm Jesus' dead body, encountering an angel who says he's risen. And then, although Mark stops the story here, other gospel writers tell us they then go on to meet the risen Jesus. Paul, when he's writing about the witnesses of the risen Jesus in 1 Corinthians 15, he doesn't mention the woman. And we'll come at 1 Corinthians 15 in a couple of weeks. 1 Corinthians 15, really important passage. Because Paul's not writing himself here, he's quoting. He's saying, what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance. He's not therefore writing about something he's kind of seen for himself, but he's writing about something he's received. And it's a kind of like a creed. It's a really, really early statement of what happened after the resurrection. It says, the Lord Jesus died according to the scriptures. He was buried. He was raised on the third day according to the scriptures. And after that, he appeared, says Paul. He appeared to Peter. He appeared to James. He appeared to the other apostles. He appeared to James. He appeared to the 500 brothers. And all the time, Paul is mentioning these witnesses, and there's a lot of them who've seen the risen Jesus, but he doesn't mention the woman. Why doesn't Paul mention the woman? I mean, they're the most important witnesses because they're the ones that actually see it first. They're the ones that get the news to go and tell the men disciples. Well, it's because of the culture. It's because of the culture in which the New Testament was written as a record of the resurrection. See, in the Jewish culture of that day, women were not taken seriously as witnesses to anything. One of the early writers I mentioned last week, a guy called Josephus, who wrote a little bit after Jesus, he said a man who had committed a crime could be caught red-handed committing the crime by any number of women, but he wouldn't be convicted by their testimony. He could have 10 women in the stand saying, we saw him do it, but he wouldn't be convicted. 10 women could say, we saw him do it, and one man come along and say he didn't do it, and that would count against all the women. That's the way it was for women in the Jewish context. The rabbis said things like this: sooner let the words of the law of God be burned than delivered to women. That's shocking. Shocking. Or another one: blessed is he whose children are male, but woe to him whose children are, you don't need me to finish the sentence, do you? Female. Under Roman law, the situation was a bit better, because in Roman law, women could actually hold legal office. But the fact is that the early church seems to have made a conscious decision in that statement in 1 Corinthians 15 to not mention the woman, although the gospel certainly mentioned it. But the early church had this kind of statement of who saw the risen Jesus, and it didn't mention the woman. And the reason seems to be that if a Christian was trying to tell a non-Christian, by the way, we believe in this man, he said he was the Son of God, he was crucified, he died, he was entombed, and then he rose from the dead. Oh yes, as a non-Christian. So who saw that then? Well, there were some women. Ah. The non-Christian would say, no way. If your witnesses are women, it didn't happen. So instead, they said, well, the woman did see it, and the gospel writers record after this, but we'll mention just the men. It's kind of a way of kind of being culturally appropriate to tell your story. It's hard for us to appreciate this, though, because we don't live in that kind of society. We've seen this week, for example, that the first world leader to visit the newly elected American president is a woman, her own Theresa May. It's a different world, completely different world. But in the first century world, mention of the woman as being the first witnesses of Jesus' resurrection was often an embarrassment. Do you see then what a strong argument that is? That we're reading history here in the Gospels. The Gospel writers tell us that Mary Magdalene and her friends were the first to see Jesus because they were. See, if you were wanting to make up a story about a man rising from the dead, or make up a story about Jesus rising from the dead in first century Palestine, what you would not do is have the witnesses to the resurrection be women. because that would just mean the story's discredited it right from the beginning. You would make men the first witnesses to the most important part of your story, that Jesus has risen, and then hope maybe people would take your concocted story seriously. The reason why the Gospels tell us it was the woman who saw Jesus first is because, however difficult that was in the cultural context, however embarrassing it was true. That's what actually happened. It was woman who saw Jesus raised from the dead first. And like I say, in our culture, we might say, well, it's bizarre that that should have been an issue or a problem. Well, that's it. But we have to get our heads around this. This is a really strong proof of the story being true. And over these weeks, I'm trying to sort of build a case on the evidence of the resurrection and show that it's something that, if you don't take seriously already, you should take seriously. And show also that if it's something you do take seriously, that you should be confident to take seriously. And to show that it's something that if other people laugh at you for taking seriously, then you've got plenty of answers to give to them that will silence their laughter and get them thinking. The woman saw the risen Jesus, and they became the first witnesses to that. Are we witnesses today? Are you a witness to the resurrection? Are you someone who lives in the sure knowledge of it? Sure hope of it? And is therefore not ashamed to tell others about it? You know that there's more than just cradle to grave. And you live in the light of that. You live in the confidence that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, is risen. And therefore you can trust him, you can pray to him, you can live for him, you can hope in him, and you've got a future in him. Maybe you're not in that place yet. And maybe Jesus is someone you need to receive. Someone that you need to receive. Well, you can do that with confidence, because this Jesus is risen. He's alive. That's why you can receive him with confidence. And these historic accounts that we call the Gospels, these strong witness testimonies, the Gospels, the Epistles, the Book of Acts and so on, these are given to us so that we can build up a picture of the most remarkable happening in the history of the world that will give us confidence as we face our own mortality, the mortality of the people around us, the sadness that shrouds communities when death has occurred, that overwhelms families, that we can face these things with confidence that there's more to it, and that we can face these things with confidence that our Jesus is alive and that there's more story to tell. He's coming. He's going to do more. He's going to raise the dead. He's going to bring judgment to the world and salvation to those who have received him, the risen Saviour. So this is not just kind of bald history for us just to kind of study out of interest. This is a glorious reality for us to commit to and live by. May God help each one of us to do so.